Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Happy midsummer, everyone. Today we have an interesting book to talk about, and I have a great guest to do that with. So we're going to talk about Cleopatra by H. Rider Haggard, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, a little bit about the book, and then we'll jump in and have my guest introduce himself. Sir Henry Rider Haggard, KBE, born 22nd of June, 1856, was an English writer of adventure fiction romances set in exotic locations, predominantly Africa, and a pioneer of the lost world literary genre. His story is situated at the lighter end of the Victorian literature, and including the 18 Allan Quatermain stories, continue to be popular and influential. After returning to England in 1882, Haggard published a book on the political situation in South Africa, as well as a handful of unsuccessful novels before writing the book for which he is most famous, King Solomon's Mines. A sequel soon followed entitled Allan Quatermain, followed by She and its sequel Aisha, swashbuckling adventure novels set in the context of the scramble for Africa, although the action of Aisha happens in Tibet. The hugely popular King Solomon's Mines is sometimes considered the first of that lost world genre. She is generally considered to be one of the classics of imaginative literature, and with 83 million copies sold by 1965, it is one of the best-selling books in history. Haggard is also remembered for Nada the Lily, a tale of adventure among the Zulus, and an epic Viking romance, Eric Brighteyes. His novels portray many of the stereotypes associated with colonialism, yet they are unusual for the degree of sympathy with which the native populations are portrayed. Africans often play heroic roles in the novels, although the protagonists are typically European. Notable exceptions are the heroic Zulu warrior Umslopogaas, probably butchered that, and Ignosi, the rightful king of Kakuna land in King Solomon's Mines. Having developed an intense mutual friendship with three Englishmen who help him regain his throne, he accepts their advice and abolishes witch hunts and arbitrary capital punishment. Three of Haggard's novels were written in collaboration with his friend Andrew Lang, who listeners might also be interested in or know who he is, who shared his interest in the spiritual realm and paranormal phenomenon. Lang wrote the Red Fairy Book in 1890, followed by the series of other fairy books of different colors. So people might be familiar with that. Cleopatra, which I found interesting, was not really mentioned in that Wikipedia thing about his work, was published in 1888. And is set in the Ptolemaic era of ancient Egyptian history and revolves around the survival of a dynasty bloodline protected by the priesthood of Isis. The main character, Hermakis, the living descendant of the pharaoh's bloodline, is charged by the priesthood to overthrow the supposed imposter Cleopatra, drive out the Greeks and Romans, and restore Egypt to its golden era. Hermakis attempts to use his priestly magic to undermine Cleopatra's rule. As in the case with the majority of Haggard's works, the story draws heavily upon adventure and exotic concepts. The story told from the point of view of the Egyptian priest Hermakis is recounted in biblical language, being in the form of papyrus scrolls found in Hermakis' tomb. Butcher and McComas, contemporary editors and critics at the time of the publishing of Cleopatra, gave the novel a mixed review, saying that it combined a not always believable portrait of its title heroine with a fascinating, wholly convincing storyline. Curtis C. Smith, writing in 1985, described Cleopatra as one of Haggard's best works, particularly for those modern readers who may find the implied defenses of colonialism in the Allan Quatermain and She series difficult to take. As Smith added, Haggard's originality is to side with this indigenous culture against the Ptolemies and the Roman imperialists who threaten Egypt. In an essay in Science Fiction Writers, Critical Studies of Major Authors from the Early 19th Century to the Present Day, published in 1999, John Scarborough included Cleopatra on a list of what he regarded as Haggard's best novels, along with King Solomon's Mines, She, A History of Adventure, Nada the Lily, Red Eve, and Eric Brighteyes. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And the person who picked this book and is going to talk about this is Frater Aaron, who some of you may also know. And I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Hi, Victoria. I'm Aaron. I am the host and moderator of Storybook Witchcraft, a storybook sacred lore of witchcraft, where we look at fairy tales, classic literature, and a little bit of ancestral folklore, and try to find out what type of hidden gems of wisdom we can polish off from them. I chose this story. It's very funny because I went through a bit of the same process that those reviews that you are reading for us mentioned. So one of the reasons was sort of a negative attribution of the fact that it probably should have been she as the most influential in our circles of interest. Mm-hmm. But the novel contains such themes of imperialism and racial politics that I didn't feel capable of tackling of giving real justice to. But I think we will end up talking a little bit about that story.
Yeah.
But I didn't think I could go in depth into that novel and do it justice. And I just wasn't really prepared to. Cleopatra is one I've always enjoyed, at least in my memory, I enjoyed. And it being midsummer, I was thinking of these solar mysteries and thinking of Egyptian Egyptian books, and especially Rosicrucian materials that have been influential in like the progression of our traditions. And this was funny, like this was a funny parallel to that, because it's a work of fiction, but it's so similar to the idea of Egypt that those practitioners in early Rosicrucianism and in circles like the Golden Dawn had of what ancient Egypt was.
Yeah. And I mean, it's practically contemporary with that, like it would have come out like, you know, in that same melee. So, I mean, I don't know if they read it, but surely Golden Dawn practitioners read adventure novels too.
Sure. And I wonder, you know, I've wondered who was Haggard writing for in general. Like adventure novels now are such a like male preteen sort of genre. Mm-hmm. And were they originally for adults? Were they always for youths? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think about like the Tarzan novels, which you want to talk about some colonialism and race politics that could be pretty complicated. You know, I read them when I was a kid, because we had them in my house because my dad had read them when he was a kid. But I don't think, you know, like Edgar Rice Burroughs particularly published for children either. Like I think, you know, I think there probably was an adult audience, though kids also read them. I mean, it's kind of like, Jack London, like, you know, mm-hmm. White Fang and all of that were books I read as a kid, but he wasn't writing for kids either. Sure. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what's interesting with like Burroughs and Haggard is that adventure genre, especially there was a lot of exoticism. It especially had to do with these expeditions into the East, into Africa, mm-hmm. which now for us has become sort of a cliche, you know, like mm-hmm. for us, it's like, it's a fantasy. It's like it's a genre fiction, but those expeditions were also happening contemporarily with Haggard as he was writing these.
Yeah.
Like those, yeah, there were explorers and hunters and all that actively making trips to and from the imperial, you know, the empire of Britain, the Outer Lands, and reporting back things that people were unfamiliar with that was mm-hmm. that were exotic to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think Haggard died in 1924. So it would have been like right after Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. All of that is happening kind of in his lifetime.
And I think the Rosetta Stone would have been being translated during his life. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was only discovered maybe a few decades before he mm-hmm. was born. And so that actual knowledge of being able to decipher the finds of ancient Egypt was still happening during mm-hmm. his life.
Yeah.
And probably affecting his understanding of the country as well. Notably, I've read that he was close friends with Budge, Wallace Budge, who mm-hmm. was the preeminent Egyptologist at the time. He was the curator of the British Museum. He's mostly I don't want to say looked down now, but he's such a product of his time that I hear Egyptologists saying that they don't like to cite Budge, except he wrote on more than really anyone else. So there are some times where you have to, because he's yeah. the only one
who's only
translated
one
or written yeah. on a source. Yeah. But yeah. his views are very much of his time and the understanding mm-hmm. of his time.
Yeah. Which, I mean, do you want to give like a quick, just because I think a lot of people probably will have not read this book. Do you want to just sure. give like a quick summary of kind of what happens?
Yeah.
And then,
yeah. So
then we can kind of talk about the story itself.
Yeah. So what's a little funny is this story is called Cleopatra, and she's really a side character. She's yes. only featured in a fraction of the novel at various intervals. Mm-hmm. The story is really of a young man throughout his life named Hermakis, and he is the royal heir of Egypt, and he is of true pharaonic blood. So he's the descendant of the last Egyptian pharaoh of Egypt. However, at the time of the novel, Egypt is run by the Ptolemies, who were Greek. A interesting element added into the story is he and Cleopatra were Cleopatra VII, who was the last pharaoh of Egypt, were born on the same day. And now she sits on the throne as the last descendant of the Ptolemies. And he secretly is surviving in a strangely titled city named Abathis, which I think is what we would call Abydos. Mm-hmm. He's prepared throughout his life to carry on the mysteries of Egypt, which at that point have become the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. And he is initiated as a priest of Isis, and he's the leader of a plot to assassinate Cleopatra and restore the rightful Egyptian heirs to the throne of Egypt. He leaves Abydos, travels to Alexandria, which is now the seat of the throne, and becomes a royal astrologer in the court of Cleopatra. A funny detail here again is he seems to dress up as a cartoon figure of Merlin. Like, they describe his robes yes. as being blue, and he wears a pointy hat with stars and moons on mm-hmm. it.
And has even
and he has a wand, a black wand, but a stage magician's wand. So it's a right. it's an ebony stick with an ivory tip, which mm-hmm. actually makes me wonder where that comes from. There are grimoires that have the ebony wand, but I don't know about the ivory tip at the front. Yeah. I wonder how that became a cliche.
I'm going to go on a lot of rabbit holes after having finished this. I confess to Aaron already, and I will tell the listener, I finished it this morning. So
good job.
I've got a lot of stuff to go back and go, where did that come from?
So he's now the royal astrologer to Cleopatra, and he's getting ready to attempt to assassinate her. She finds out secretly and decides to battle wits against him by using her seductive charms. Mm. And she wins. She makes him fall in love with her and drugs him so that he falls asleep and is unable to slay her, and imprisons him. And they strangely become friends after this. They become mm-hmm. friends and lovers. And she promises him that they should actually marry and unite the two royal lines now of Egypt, which sounds like a great solution. She may be doing this only to find out the secrets of the pharaohs, which is a hidden treasure lying somewhere in Egypt to be used when Egypt's need is at its greatest, but she doesn't know where it is. With his help, they do find the secret of the pharaohs and the treasures within, which she uses to fund her sea voyage to meet Anthony, mm-hmm. Mark Anthony, who she does fall in love with. And there is there's a very nice love story, secondary love story narrative about Cleopatra and Mark Anthony. Hermakis flies. He takes up a secret identity and plots the long game for decades, it seems, until he's finally able to come back towards the end of the novel when Cleopatra and Anthony are losing their battles to Rome. And he delivers Cleopatra's famous poison at the end of her life. And when she is dying from the poison, he reveals that it is he, Harmakis, who has been plotting all along and finally delivering the curse of the pharaohs to her for plundering mm-hmm. their secrets. Yeah. And then she dies. But she has a last laugh where she tells him that while she may be cursed, he's the one who has truly lost because he's never known true love. Whereas her and Anthony did experience true love, and now they'll be united in the lands beyond. Mm-hmm. I left out a very major character whose name is Charmian. She's in most versions of the story of Cleopatra the Seventh as her one of her handmaidens. And in this one, while you would think Harmakis is kind of turning the gears of the story, you find out towards the end that Charmian has actually been secretly controlling most of the events of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is really the ultimate betrayer in the novel.
Yeah.
I mean, she betrays both Harmakis and Cleopatra ultimately. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It was, they mentioned in the Wikipedia part that I read that it's in biblical language, which I thought was kind of a strange way to describe it. I mean, it is, I mean, King James era, the way they talk kind of.
Yeah, the prose are, but the dialogue, I actually thought he was trying to mimic Shakespeare, except badly.
Yeah, that was more kind of what I took away from it. I thought it was interesting to call it biblical, and I was like, it's more Shakespearean. But despite that like, I guess, hurdle to get over it, mm-hmm. Like it is an adventure novel. Like you kind of mm-hmm. get sucked up in the story. I mean, as also there are some Cleopatra in many points in the book points out how much she dislikes the Jews or the Judeans.
And they come out of nowhere. You know, it happens a handful of times, but it's so weird. It comes out of nowhere when she's speaking.
So I'm sure there is some writer intrusion in some of those things. But and I was like, well, that's a strange
historical fact. I do not know Cleopatra the Seventh's thought on the Jewish residents of Alexandria.
Yeah.
But I do believe I've heard that it was one of her ancestors. So there was a line of Cleopatras that, mm-hmm. Eventually led to Cleopatra the Seventh, that it was one of the line of Cleopatras in the house of Ptolemy who had brought them from exile, like in Persia and Syria, to Egypt. Alexandria.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird mash of like, there's like clear historical truth and then this overlay of the fictional story of Harmakis. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you're kind of like, wait, did he make this all up?
Yes, that's something that's interesting about many of his novels. I haven't read them all by any means, mm-hmm. but there is a really interesting mix of fact and fiction to make it mm-hmm. more believable,
yeah.
but it makes it confusing then what parts are made up. And I do think, again, for the time, I think he had a very deep knowledge about Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Well, and seemingly a deep respect too. Like the thing I did find was interesting is that even writing from, you know, the late 1800s, when less enlightened times, I guess let's put it that way. The champion of the story really is the native Egyptian person, not
yes, exactly.
the Ptolemies, not the Romans, you know, it's really from and told from his point of view.
Yes, exactly.
So I think that was interesting. And there is none of that. There's no like noble savage stuff going on here. Like he really respected the culture and this idea.
The Romans, I think, would have been the closest analogy to the British and, mm-hmm. you know, the empirical British. So it is very interesting that you are on the side of Harmakis, the indigenous Egyptian mm-hmm. in the cause. And there had been uprisings against the Ptolemies in the centuries that they ruled leading up again to Cleopatra the Seventh. And she does mention one of her grandfathers stamping out a revolt. And so I think that's, mm-hmm. I actually think that's a reference to one of the actual uprisings.
Yeah.
That makes the plot again, more believable.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I found interesting in it and kind of, I guess, to the theme overall of our podcast is the magic in it is kind of almost secondary to the story. Yeah. I mean, it's there and it's quite CGI magic in a lot of ways, but it's very subtle in the telling of the story, even though you realize that, you know, Hermakis has in the beginning before his downfall is basically a servant of Isis and wields her power in some ways on Earth, which I thought was a really interesting approach to it. And it just kind of made me wonder, like, I know I'm going to go down an Isis rabbit hole after this, but it was really interesting to me, like how he portrayed the magic, which is also kind of cinematic. I mean, it does kind of have that, like, you can tell why this was one of the first of his books that was made into a film.
There's a great scene where it's a callback to the Exodus episode where Moses and Aaron turn their turn the staff into a snake, and Hermakis turns his staff into a snake for Cleopatra, and she says, "Oh, that's old magic. I've seen that done a number of times." But then the snakes keep reproducing until they're drowning in a sea of snakes. And yeah, it's like an early imagination of what would now be an overload of CGI. It's very funny.
Yeah. And like when he encounters Isis in the temple, when he has his like ordeal to be truly, I guess, a priest of Isis and then crowned
initiation.
The Pharaoh. Yeah. It's like it's not that far-fetched to what even a contemporary person would say their encounters with their gods are. Like it's right. Really quite beautifully done. I was really pleasantly surprised.
When I was younger and read this and other novels like Wicked and Son of a Witch or Miss of Avalon, there's a central character who is given, we are told, great power, great potential for power. And I would always be surprised that we never really saw the payoff of that through the novel, like a scene where they had maybe like a Carrie-style mass destruction or mass show of power. But it would always, there would be things where like struggles and times where then they would forget their, you know, forget their practices, forget their gifts for a while, and then struggle to regain them. And that seems like something I've noticed throughout various works. And when I was younger, I was frustrated about some characters because of that. And now I think I've reached an age where more than anything, I identify with that, you know, and there is an element of that in Hermakis because he has this strong initiatory experience. He has direct communion with the goddess Isis and is told, you know, he's going to sit on the throne of Egypt if he follows a certain path. And then, of course, life gets in the way.
In the form of two women, really.
The form of Cleopatra, of course.
Yeah, Cleopatra so and Charmian to some extent. I mean, Charmian is the bigger architect of his downfall in so many ways.
She is. She's like the center of the spikes of all the wheel, spokes of all the wheel. Mm-hmm. So there is there's some great sexism and misogyny in the novel.
Yeah.
There's also some great female strength in the novel. But there's a lot of sexism and misogyny in there.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it kind of rears its head in the form of essentialism. Like women are this way. All women are this way. And this is, you know, your downfall will be women because all women are this thing. And it's funny, like he's warned by, the old woman.
Great.
Yeah. He's warned by Isis. He's warned by his father. He's warned by Sepa. He's warned by everybody that women are going to be his downfall. And he is like, la-di-da, I'm above all that. I'm a priest of Isis. I don't need a woman. And then bam.
And I thought this was a little important too, because there are male practitioners who will say things like, I'm an initiate of the goddess. I can't be misogynist. I'm a priest of the goddess. I can't be sexist. And here's a really good example of how that actually does happen. Although, I mean, this is a fictitious novel, but it is showing some characteristics. Yeah, it's showing some real characteristics. And, you know, of a character who's saying, I was so innocent that these women just take advantage of me all the time. And that's when you come across that in real life. And I've heard that it can be a little bit of a red flag.
Yeah. 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 I too have heard that spouted, and I'm like, it doesn't quite gel with what you've said previously or things I've seen you do previously. Yeah. But the women are interestingly written because there is a lot of their softness and their roundness and the gauziness of their clothes. And, you know, it's just very feminine, but he does also talk about like the steel in them in Charmian and in Cleopatra. Like he also sees the strength of these characters. Yeah. And so, and you know, like there's one passage where he's talking, you know, he and Cleopatra have this long conversation about the stars, and he sees her as an intelligent person. And I think that's when he really falls in love with her.
Sure.
Is when her intellect is revealed to him as he sees it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, the intellect was there all the time.
And there's a scene where I don't remember who it is, but maybe the messenger from Anthony or somebody comes to speak to Cleopatra, and she tells him, tell me what language you want to speak in. All languages are known to us, mm-hmm. you know, because she speaks so many of the known languages at the time.
Yeah.
And it is repeated often how brilliant she is.
I do think it's interesting. I mean, I don't know, like, I know that the kind of mythos of Cleopatra as this, like, just beauty above all beauties existed, you know, and now we have a better idea of perhaps what she really looked like. But I find it interesting that, you know, in Hagrid's book, she is like the most beautiful woman to ever grace the planet. And yet in reality, her beauty really came from within, it sounds like. I mean,
sure. Yeah.
Granted, it was the intellect beauty standards and the charm. Were different at the time, but it was really her wit and intellect that got her where she got to.
There is a strong female figure in many of his works. And I think most notably is Aisha in She. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, like I said, I was not really comfortable real excited to speak about that one. Although I think it's probably the most influential spiritually and in modern spirituality, is because he does venture into foreign lands. And then when he meets the ruling queen, who is basically a goddess, she's white.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Yeah. And I did notice that with that Cleopatra and Anthony and Hamakis, and they all are blue eyed. And I'm like,
they all have blue eyes.
Probably not. They were not blue-eyed people. Most likely they were not. And, you know, there is some of that, like the purity attached to the paleness of the people that is present in his work, even in this one.
And what I think is really interesting about that too is, so Aisha was reportedly influential to many writers, but including writers like Tolkien for Galadriel and C.S. Lewis for The White Witch. But even one of the novels I thought about suggesting for us, the Queen of the Dam, Anne Rice just took Aisha and put her in the vampire novels and changed her name a little bit to Akasha.
Yeah.
And explained the whiteness that she was so old, her skin had become marble. So now she was, you know, or like marble. So now she was white. But it's essentially the same character with the same agenda that she had in writer's novel. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of overlap, it seems like, with that figure, the figure that like Blavatsky writes about in Icy Sun Veiled, and a lot of what turned into later spirituality and goddess movement. And we see some of that in this novel too. And like I said, how a lot of those expeditions were happening contemporarily with Hagrid, there were also these reports coming back of explorers encountering what they were calling the lost tribes or white residents in Africa and other places. Mm-hmm. And And they probably were finding things like this, but the thing, because, you know, pigmentation and inhabitants and everything, people aren't just one thing. They don't have to be, they don't have to be a lost race to have, you know, to have slightly different pigmentation. But these were all ideas that were like in the consciousness, like what, like would be trending for us nowadays. They were all contemporary when he was writing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do think it is like an interesting snapshot of the time, and even down to the language, like you realize even when he speaks about the Kemetic religion, that so much of his terminology is filtered through Christianity.
Yes.
Like, you know, even they introduced the idea of hell several times by name and, you know, so you and kind sin. Of can play that game. Is it the translator? Is it, you know, the right, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing, but I was like, oh yeah, there's so much that is filtered through his Englishness and his Christianity.
And again, I think that was the way Egyptologists and magicians, people like the Golden Dawn, were approaching the Egyptian mysteries at the time. They were approaching them through this Christian lens. So when he writes, he has a vision where he actually sees the death and resurrection of Osiris, and Isis is giving him this vision. But it's not, it doesn't play out the way like I would hear that story now. And it's given this very Christo solar interpretation of of how it happens. And also, as was, I believe, the understanding at the time too, it's portrayed that Osiris had physically ruled over Egypt at some point. So he, you know, he was a physical pharaoh for a golden age of Egypt when this began.
Because the pharaohs saw themselves descended from Egypt, saw themselves descended from Isis and Osiris. That part was interesting, and kind of related to that, Hamakis has several visions where he sees kind of a future Egypt, a future Alexandria, where many religions have come and gone, and you know, the same gods called by different names, and all this. So I think Haggard does an interesting thing there with that idea that because they are prophets, they can see into this future that is now, or Haggard's time even.
And I think that's one of the reasons that this novel has stayed in, like, in my memory and my consciousness for so long, is I read it when I was a bit younger. Later when I was researching, you know, not just reading for entertainment, but researching things about Hermeticism and Neoplatonism, and sort of like the threads that have filtered into modern esoteric circles. There's a lot of the Corpus Hermetica that, in my mind, echoed things I'd read in this novel, like refreshed memories of this novel. So one of the themes of how we have this collection of works that we call the Corpus Hermetica is that it was a last endeavor for the priests of the Egyptian cults, the Egyptian mysteries, to preserve their sacred knowledge, and that they had written it down in the language of Greek philosophy so that it would be preserved as in the time of Alexandria. So Alexandria was the center of Egypt at the time, the center of, in some sense, the Greek world, philosophically speaking, and academically speaking. And Greek was the overall language spoken at in Alexandria at the time. So there is a theory that the Corpus, the Hermetic texts, were a last effort of the initiatory priests of Egypt to preserve their teachings. And so they used the predominant language of the time. They used the language of Greek philosophy, and so that those texts would be able to be spread throughout the Greek empire, the Greek speaking world, which does have, you know, it does have the echoes in this story with Hermakis being the priests of Isis having this last effort to continue their line. But then in the Hermetic text, in the one that's usually considered, usually included as the last text in most bound collections, is called the Asclepius. There's a prophecy given how Egypt will fall and the gods will leave Egypt and foreigners will rule over the land. And Egypt, which once had been a heaven on earth, would now just become worldly and ungodly until, you know, sometime far off. And that's basically what Isis speaks to Harmakhis mm-hmm. in some of the visions, especially mm-hmm. when now he's fallen from her graces mm-hmm. and will not become pharaoh. She tells him that's what's going to happen. And when I hear it referred to or read about it referred to sometimes in the Hermetic text, I still think of it in my mind as, oh, that's the prophecy of Isis. Although in the Hermetic text, it's not. It would most likely be attributed to Thoth or to Hudi, Thoth Hermes. Mm-hmm. But those ideas were already in my consciousness mm-hmm. from this novel.
Yeah. And so, Isis leaving Egypt, like in one of his yes. visions, he shows to people with his magic, he shows Isis leaving as a cloud above Egypt. Yeah.
And it's funny because some of the magic in the novel, like, would be coincidence. Some of it is very much conjured, but some of it, it's hard to tell. Was it only conjured? Was it coincidence? Does it matter? It's effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm kind of in that. I mean, you've touched on like your experience with this novel kind of as, I guess, a young magic practitioner mm-hmm. and kind of how you relate to it now, older. But what do you think, like, was this novel part of what set you on the path? Or how do you kind of relate it in your own worldview, I guess?
The interest in like the mystique of Egypt and the mystery of Egypt was one of the things that I would say was an early inclination of my interest in the path and into mysteries in general. So that began before reading the novel. It is one of the things that then made me pick up the novel, mm-hmm. you know, just because of it dealing with, you know, and it was for entertainment. It was a fun piece of Egyptian adventure. But then as other aspects of life, you know, led me into ceremonial magic and Hermeticism and Neoplatonism. Again, the themes that had already, that this novel had primed in me, you know, kept being refreshed. It's something that I would remember fondly. And rereading it, I will say it was a bit of a chore to reread. But I would get through anywhere from a page to, you know, a good handful of pages every night before bed. But yeah, it was a bit more tedious than I remembered.
Yeah. I know, it's always funny to me, like, I read so much, like, the book I'm working on right now requires me reading a lot of stuff written in the 1800s and some older stuff. I mean, I studied Old English in graduate school mm-hmm. and Middle English. And so, you know, like, this is actually quite modern language compared to those. Mm-hmm. But it's still funny, like, how used we are to this very, how different our speech pattern is now and how we write differently now. And how much it slows you down when you're reading to read and like this kind of, and I think he's even throwing back further. Like, he's not writing English of his own time. He's purposely writing this Shakespearean biblical language. Yeah. So it is even more tedious in some ways to get through. But I will say, and I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now. I think I'm still kind of like digesting everything, but there's some really beautiful passages too. Like, he's actually quite an amazing writer. Like, his descriptions of things are, he has such a good way to set you in place.
Yeah.
That I think is just really beautiful. And again, surprising, I had not read any of, I mean, I've seen King Solomon's Mines, the movie, but I'd never read the books. I've never read any of his books. I was more, I guess because we had the better house, I was more Edgar Rice Burroughs as a kid than Haggard. Mm-hmm. But it was just interesting to see like him as a, to like read the work as a writer and like the craft of it is pretty interesting. Like, even though he's doing this archaic thing that is supposed to be translated from these scrolls found in Hamaki's tomb, that it's still, there's still this like modern novel sensibility about the book.
There's this one image that again has stuck with me since my first read through, which is early on in the book, he's been given news about his ancestry and about his future, and he's feeling a little overwhelmed, but he climbs on top of one of the pylons. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the thing. To me, the pylons look like they're just meant to be.
Yeah.
They're like gates sort of, you know, yeah. So, but he climbs on top of a pylon, one of the giant structures outside of the temple, and night falls over Egypt and the moon rises, and he's standing there watching how beautiful everything is, and he prays to Isis under the light of the moon. And it's exoticism, but it's really beautifully written. And that image has always stuck with me.
He kind of echoes it when he goes to Alexandria too. Like he wakes up early one morning and climbs to the roof of Sepphoris's house and watches Alexandria and the sunrise. And
the sun come up over Alexandria. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how beautiful Alexandria is, and his uncle rebukes him.
It's like, this is a worldly, godless city. Yeah. How dare you? Yes, it needs to be razed to the ground. Yeah. Yeah. His uncle is kind of a hoot in his own right.
So the uncle comes across as like abusive to his own daughter. His daughter is Charmian, Cleopatra's handmaiden, but he rebukes her too because he has a dream. Dreams, and now that I say that, dreams play a really important function throughout the novel, which is something which I would say is something that like I want to not believe, but that is a very important. It's a very important aspect of how I gather knowledge as well. So I identify a lot with how they're used in the novel. But he's had a dream where blood rains down on Egypt, and it's from it's at Charmian's call. Mm-hmm. So he verbally abuses her, but at this point nothing's happened, and so she's hurt. And I think that's just fascinating because it does come to pass. She foils the whole plot for the Egyptians to revolt and take back the country. But at that point, the idea hadn't entered her mind yet, and he's already punishing her for it. Mm-hmm. So it's an unusual part of the novel where, you know, he's wrong for abusing her. At the same time, she does end up bringing about the fall of Egypt.
When he even asks her to interpret his dream.
Yeah.
Like, what does this mean? And she's like, I'm not a soothsayer. This is not my job to tell you what this dream is.
I mean, how many of us wake up from a dream where our spouse did something really bad and then are not sure if we should be angry or not?
Why am I mad at you?
Yeah. No, I usually try to laugh about it when I wake up, but occasionally there's some where I'm thinking, wait, this might be prophetic.
Yeah. And there's some, Hagrid really, like you said, dreams are really important. And then there's a moment in that meeting of Mark Antony and Cleopatra when she asks him to remove her diadem because her head hurts or whatever. And he's like, oh, I would not take this from you. You know, it's this very like kind of symbolic moment. But then when Hamakas and Charmian are watching them secretly from this like priest hole kind of in the boat, and he puts it back on, but it falls off her head and rolls away. And he's like, oh, I saw the omen that none of them saw. And I was like, you know, oh, to write historic novels, would you know the future?
Right, you already know the outcome.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's so nice to be able to lay that foreshadowing so well. Yeah,
and for, you know, we've mentioned how he gives them very Shakespearean dialogue. Interestingly, he mostly focuses on scenes that Shakespeare avoided. So it's sort of like where you're seeing, you're seeing the scenes between the scenes of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. with the exception of Cleopatra's death. And he's not Shakespeare. Shakespeare gives them surprisingly very, very sparse short speeches, and these go on.
They go on.
They
monologue a lot. They monologue a lot in this book.
Antony, and this is in other sources as well. So his next man, his footman, is named Eros. Mm-hmm. And I've always found that really intriguing too. Like, Antony and Cleopatra are these now archetypal legendary lovers, and Antony has a reputation his own. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, he was,
they actually call him a Eros. Skirt chaser in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
almost to that phrase, they call him a skirt chaser.
And yeah, his servant is Eros, and they have mm-hmm. children. And it is true, they named their children Helios and Selene, mm-hmm. Antony Helios and Cleopatra Selene, the sun and the moon.
And Cleopatra Selene is the only one we really know, like, the history of, because she was married off to an African king and then intermarried with Roman royalty after that. The two sons, we don't really know what happened to them, right?
Right. So we know she had a son with Caesar, Caesarion, who mm-hmm. was certainly killed by Augustus Caesar. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what happened to Antony Helios.
Mm-mm. And then there is like a Ptolemy, like the youngest son of theirs is also named Ptolemy, I think.
Okay.
And he also, there's like no record really of what happens to him. They think he perhaps died of like an illness, like in 29 sure. BC or something. Sure. But Selene is the only one we really know what happens to.
There's a, probably like a 50s or 60s film, you know, one of those old Egyptian epics, mm-hmm. but where the son of Cleopatra and Caesar comes back. Mm-hmm. To wage war. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
We recommend that. Yeah.
Speaking of film, so I always try to do like a little dive around the book. And so this was made into a film in 1917 starring Theda Bara, which is uh-huh. kind of cool, but it's a lost film.
It's so lost.
We don't have it. There are some clips on YouTube, and there's actually a clip on Wikipedia if you go look at the film on Wikipedia.
Oh, cool.
And it was pre Hays Code. So she has on like basically big pasties and a scarf. And
I love it.
I would love to see it. Like, I mean, I think we have less than a minute total mm-hmm. of the runtime of it, because it showed up in like a sales reel almost for like a kind of like a home movie thing is why we even have any of it. But I am amazed. Honestly, it is a cinematic book. It would today, like if someone picked it up and made a film from it, it works as a movie. Yeah, plot.
I would love that. I don't think it should be called Cleopatra, but I would love that.
No, I think it should be Carmackes.
Or something, you know, something, whatever. Yeah. Revolt on, you know.
Revolt of the Ptolemy.
Revolt on Cleopatra. No, yeah, that sounds something. Really bad.
Yeah, I do find it interesting. And part of me, like just as a writer and a publisher, was like, I wonder if you called it Cleopatra, because that is way easier to market.
So here's a little funny story. One of my first exposures to the book, there was a audio adaption, and it was narrated by a British actress named Honor Blackman. She's a 60s actress, and mm-hmm. she has a great gravelly voice. Mm-hmm. And so they changed Harmakis to a female priestess of Isis named Olympia.
Interesting.
And in my mind, I had always explained this away as, they hired her for the job. She saw Cleopatra and then got the script and was like, there's no Cleopatra in this, you know? But probably it was actually to avoid the overt sexism of the mm-hmm. book, because it was a modern adaption.
Yeah.
That's probably more realistic.
That's but really yeah, funny.
In my mind, it was always that they hired her for Cleopatra and then found out that Cleopatra wasn't the character.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. Like the book is broken down into three books, like three scrolls that they found in his tomb. And the first one does not involve Cleopatra at all. Like, she doesn't appear in it at all. So you don't get Cleopatra until book two. And what's funny is in the introduction that Haggard wrote in the edition I have, which is like from, I think, the Gutenberg Project, but it was like published as an ebook.
Okay.
And so Haggard's original introduction was in it. And he basically says, if you're more interested in Cleopatra, you should just skip to book two.
Oh.
If you're not interested in the religion of the of the Egyptians, and you're just want here for Cleopatra, just start a book too.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. But it is the longest book of the three. This the middle section is really
okay.
The meat of the book, if you want to look at it that
and
way.
So then that's where she is. And then that has probably my next favorite moment of the book is when they journey across the sands of Egypt to find the secret of the mm-hmm. pharaohs, and they have to plunder a great pyramid.
Yeah. And that whole scene is very cinematic. Like that was
scary. I can see this. Like Uchi mentioned, that is scary.
Yeah. They encounter, I don't know if you can spoil like a 140-year-old book, but they encounter something in the pyramid. Let's put it that way. But so if you had recommended this book to someone, what would be the next thing you suggested they read?
After Cleopatra?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. If they liked Haggard and wanted to continue, I would say She. Mm-hmm. If they needed something a bit more up to date, I might actually say to jump to Anne Rice, The Vampire Lestat and the Queen of the Damned, and mm-hmm. how she deals with really the same genre as Haggard, but masquerading as vampire fiction mm-hmm. or something, or with the vampire overlay.
Yeah, it also made me think of Ramses the Damned.
Oh yeah, of course. Right.
Which for a long time was actually one of my favorite of her novels. But yeah, Queen of the Damned. I think Queen of the Damned gets slighted some because the movie of it is what more people know. And the movie's not great.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun to watch, but it's not a great
either.
Movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not faithful either. So
yeah.
You could still read the book.
But I think the book is really interesting because it has so much mythology in it and kind of how she deals with it and brings these, like actual Egyptian mythology and kind of this like pop fiction adventure mm-hmm. aspect of it is all there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a big shift, I think, between the first three books, like, mm-hmm. you know, between Interview into Lestat and then from Lestat into Queen of the Damned. Mm-hmm. There's such a shift in narrative styles, and they work. It works together. But yeah, you get something different from each of them. In Haggard's Cleopatra, there's the added benefit of there are interesting little songs and mm-hmm. hymns and spells, which are like italicized or in a separate meter, so you can spot them quick when you're flipping through. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't discourage anyone from using them realistically.
The dirge that Charmian sings as Cleopatra dies is quite beautiful. I mean, it was really, really well done. Yeah. Haggard had some talent writing in his time. So.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So any, I guess, final thoughts that we didn't get to that you'd like to share?
It's funny because there were so many various ways that we can discuss this novel. I think we probably touched on all the major ones.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, thank you for recommending it, because it's not something I probably would have picked up on my own. And I feel like it was an interesting read. And like I said, I can see the rabbit holes before me, because I really want the wand thing. I really now need to know the origin of that.
Where did the magician's wand come from?
Yeah.
A question for you. Do you have a favorite adaption, cinematic or otherwise, of Cleopatra the Seventh?
Well, I mean, to just watch the pageantry and like over the topness of it, I love Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra. Like, I just love to watch it. I mean, it's a ridiculous movie. Like, I don't even know if people still like kind of watch it, but like, it was at the time, it was like the most expensive movie made, which is interesting because the Theda Bara one was also incredibly expensive.
Interesting.
And I was like, huh, Cleopatra just costs money apparently. But I think her portrayal of it is such of its own time too. Like, that movie is so much of its own time. But it's just the pageantry and just the Hollywood bigness of it is fun to watch.
Yeah. So, and in full color.
In full color.
I really love the music in that one as well too. Mm-hmm. I would agree. It's the 60s film. And I'm embarrassed to say, but as I'm reading Haggard's Cleopatra, I'm hearing Elizabeth Taylor and Cleopatra's lines.
Well, it's funny because he talks about her eyes being violet. And I was like, oh, right. That's like Elizabeth Taylor.
It's perfect.
You know, yeah, it was just so funny that he, and you know, Elizabeth Taylor wasn't even born yet. I don't even know if her parents were born yet when he wrote this book. Right. So, I mean, that was pretty interesting because it immediately made me think of Elizabeth Taylor when he mentions that her eyes are not only blue, they're violet.
Yes. I caught that as well. So yeah, it's funny. It influences my read now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How could it not? I mean, she is so iconic as an actress. So, and I think of her roles, even I think a lot of people see her in that role. Like when you think of Elizabeth Taylor, that sure. is the role.
Sure.
Like her in her full majesty.
So, if anyone is going to go watch the film because of this, another interesting aspect is it took so long to film and she had various health conditions throughout filming that you can tell like what was filmed towards the beginning mm-hmm. of the shoot and towards the end because she looks completely different. Yeah. So, she like transforms as a woman throughout the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting ride. Yeah, there's so many of those big like 60s. Movies that I think are just kind of like Ben-Hur and,
right.
you know, like all of those just like huge epic films, which we don't really make like that anymore. We don't really make those kind of right. movies that much, or at least right. not that don't involve, you know, 20,000 extras, like yeah. stuff like that doesn't really yeah. happen anymore. So, well, cool. Well, Aaron, thank you so much. And like I said, thanks for picking this book and thanks for being game to do this. I mean,
thank you. It was such a generous invitation. Thank you for having me here. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book. When I started reading it, I was like, oh, maybe I should go pick something else.
Folks who don't know, I also appeared on Aaron's show to talk about gnomes. So if you enjoyed yes. Aaron here, you should definitely go check out his podcast. And you can even listen to an episode with me if you want to.
So. Perfect.
Excellent. Well, let's perhaps do this again. Maybe Queen of the Damned is in our future.
Okay. Another Midsummer Away or something.
I like it. I like it. Excellent. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.